Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile?
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today I'm joined by our intrepid, and I'm going to go ahead and say this, regal producer, Scott Gregory. Scott is a bona fide music aficionado and host of All This Jazz, which you can hear Saturdays on Public Radio Tulsa. We've spent the last few weeks digging up music and bands inspired by art, artists, and even some museums. The results are eclectic to say the least, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Okay, so let's get into it, Jeff, with an artist who has done a lot of pop music directly inspired by visual artists, and that's Jonathan Richman.
Yeah, so Jonathan Richman is this guy who was in a band called the Modern Lovers, which was this punk band post-Velvet Underground. They kind of came up in the 70s,
right.
Kind of even before Ramones and Sex Pistols like that. But he goes and spins off into this whole other thing. I actually just saw him at the Blue Door in Oklahoma City, this great little kind of folk venue they
right.
have there. There
right.
were maybe 60 people there. You know, Jonathan Richman's in his mid to late 60s now.
Okay.
And it was him on a nylon string acoustic guitar, not plugged into any amplification, and a drummer, and that was it. And
right.
He's done songs about Vermeer and Picasso and Van Gogh.
And people might remember him as the sort of one-man chorus in that movie, Something About Mary.
Yeah, so he and this guy, this drummer, They show up a few times and there's something
okay.
about Mary. And
two-man chorus.
Yeah, and that was probably their biggest claim to fame in terms of popular culture. But he's still out there doing it, and he did this, there's no one like Vermeer. And, you know, he's just, there are these amazing, very verbose songs about his love of art and painters. And,
yeah.
You know, there's an audience for that, at least 60 people that were in the audience for me.
Right, so. Right. Hopefully there's an audience for that with this podcast. That's kind of what we're doing here, is we're going to get into some artists that we appreciate. And
some we don't.
Exactly. And
well, the idea that, you know, the concept of the muse or people, you know, art inspires art. You know,
right.
People are always bouncing around from different things. So a painting could inspire a song, and a song can inspire a painting. And it kind of goes all over the place. So
absolutely.
We've been kind of scouring the internet and the vinyl and everything else to kind of find these. I'm going to call them hidden gems.
Sure.
Can we call them hidden gems?
Yeah.
There's no huge hits here, really.
Well, you know, maybe a few hits in the sense that, like, they're really well-known and maybe even classics in some case. But I'm going to fire an opening salvo
here. Yeah, you go.
Here.
Do it.
There's this famous painting by Mondrian, Broadway Boogie Woogie.
Pete Mondrian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Primary Colors.
Yeah. Completed in 1943 in the holdings of the Museum of Modern Art. A few years ago, that August Institution had a concert, and one of the people on the bill was this hot young jazz piano player. He's like 30-something, from Ohio originally, just an amazing player, Aaron Deal, now based in Harlem. He was playing there, and part of the gig was, you're going to perform at the Museum of Modern Art, but we want you to do a piece. We are commissioning a piece that's directly inspired by one of our works. So he wrote a piece called Broadway Boogie Woogie. Let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
Okay, so again, Broadway Boogie Woogie, Aaron Deal on piano. And that's really not...
For MoMA.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And from an album that Deal put out a couple of years ago, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, called Space-Time Continuum. And it's not really boogie-woogie music per se, but it's bebop jazz, it's frenetic, it's New York City.
Which is interesting to me, because when I think of, you know, I don't know if this was intentional, but Mondrian seems so purposeful and so composed, those straight lines.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think of it as chaos. That almost seems more like a de Kooning or something. You know, that,
sure,
something like a Jackson Pollock, the kind of scattered nature of that.
Although within the painting, I was just checking it out, there are all these movements of the... I don't want to call them dots, but like it's almost like a traffic pattern, an aerial view
like
of the
grid,
city.
Like a grid, like a city grid.
Yeah, it's a totally active grid.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so there's, you know, maybe the sound of that grid. What have you got?
So I want to go back to when I was a teenager in the early 90s.
Okay.
And I loved these kind of girl bands like the Cranberries, and I loved the Sundays, which was one of my favorite bands.
Right, and those were
Mazzy
like contemporaneous
Star.
Groups of the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, Mazzy Star. You know, I would just sit around and think dark thoughts and listen to these girls sing to me in my bedroom. So there's a band called the Weepies. It's a husband and wife duo, a contemporary group. And they sing a song about Chagall called Painting by Chagall. And I was wanting to do something about Chagall. And I kind of thought for a second maybe we'd do something from the soundtrack of Fiddler on the Roof, you know?
Yeah, right.
Which was inspired by Chagall's paintings. But I wasn't in a Broadway space when I was picking these. So this is a painting by Chagall by the Weepies. So that's Painting by Chagall by the Weepies. That stuff to me is just like a warm bath. It's like nostalgia. I want to just go back to 1993.
Right.
And I don't know. And it kind of does capture, you know, when I think of Chagall, not to get too crazy here, but, you know, those kind of ethereal imagery of these floating
right.
know, figures in space. And it does have that kind of element where it's just very light, you know, it's
okay.
very airy. There's a lot of air in there, and I like being in that space.
I was just thinking earlier you said you weren't in a particularly like Broadway musical mindset when you were
Which happens
your...
often.
No.
I'm not too, for me at least.
Hey, speak for yourself. I've got to warn everyone right now that I might throw some Mandy Patinkin at you later.
Are you going Sondheim?
I might get some Sunday in the Park with George into the mix. In fact, so let's do that right now, actually. This is from the 1984 Broadway musical. For those not familiar, it's very much inspired by the pointillist Seurat and his signature work.
Seen in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, yeah.
Stared at by Cameron for quite a long time.
Totally. And the show itself deals with a character, George, quite obviously the painter. But then in the second act, it's George's great-grandson, also named George and also an artist. So the show's a lot about, like, family and tradition and all of these things that maybe you don't get from the painting immediately, but when you stare at that group of people and you enter that world, that's really what we're doing with all of these songs.
And we're talking pre-Princess Bride Mandy Patinkin here.
Yeah,
right?
We are. This is what he was, a Broadway star, yeah. But not yet the whatever. Was he a villain in that film?
He started bad, but he ended good.
Thank you. Okay, so this is Finishing the Hat, really a song about creativity and the creative process.
Finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from a window while you finish the hat. Mapping out a sky. What you feel like planning a sky. What you feel when voices that come through the window will they distance and die until there's nothing but sky? And how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light. How the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to the night. Dizzy from the height, coming from the hat, studying the hat, entering the world of the hat, reaching through the world of the hat like a window, back to this one from that, studying a face.
Music from Sunday in the Park with George, Mandy Patinkin, and Entering the World of the Hat, a song about creating something where there was nothing there before, and really more generally about how in art and through art, we enter into other worlds. And that's what really what we're doing with these songs right here.
You know, I saw Stephen Sondheim in conversation with Frank Rich a few years ago.
Yeah, here at 2U.
Yeah, and he had put out a collection of his lyrics called Finishing the Hat, I believe.
Now you know where that comes from.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. But what's interesting is anytime I hear something like that, there has to be somewhere in me a theater guy. There's a theater guy
in
there. Because when I hear that, I feel
the
need to
light,
express
man.
Myself.
Yes.
You know, and I feel something bubbling up when I do that. Maybe
come
I'm,
on in. The
maybe I'm
fine.
Repressing myself.
No,
I don't
no,
know.
No. It's all good.
But I love the idea of a musical, for example, based off of inspired by a painting.
Yes,
and that's what we're talking about. The
absolutely.
Idea that there's a cyclical nature to the muse, right? And there's always different things coming off of, you know, a book inspired by a painting inspired by a song. This is endless track.
It goes on and on.
So I'm going to jump over to not George, but Georgette. More specifically, Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war, which is actually not just a Paul Simon song,
okay,
but the caption of a photograph that Paul Simon saw. And it sounds like a photograph, you know, when you hear that title, Renee
yeah.
and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war,
right.
You know, a caption
it's
for
like
a photograph.
It's like a title, right.
And it comes from his album Hearts and Bones, which was probably one of his lesser albums, I guess, in terms of sales, in terms of cultural impact. And but this song, which is a very gentle song, which talks about Rene and Georgette Magritte, Rene Magritte being the great surrealist painter, the
right.
painter of the bowler hat with the apple, the painter
apples.
Of this is not a pipe. You know,
sure. That's where the Beatles got Apple Records, that logo, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
The son of man. And so what's interesting is Paul Simon was obviously inspired by this photograph, but also inspired by this art. And he's writing about this relationship, this very gentle relationship. But where it goes absurd is it's Paul Simon talking about Rene and Georgette Magritte dancing and listening to doo-wop from the 50s.
Okay.
So he talks about bands like the Moon Glows and the Five Satins and all these other doo-wop bands that he loved, you know, growing up in New York
right.
in the 1950s. And so there's some weird elements going on here, but a truly beautiful song. So this is Rene and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war.
Rene and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war returned to their hotel suite and they unlocked the door. Easily losing their evening clothes, they danced by the light of the moon to the penguins. The Moon Glows, the Orioles, the Five Satins, the deep forbidden music they'd been longing for. Rene and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war. Rene and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war. Was strolling down Christopher Street when they stopped in a men's store.
Christopher Street in Greenwich Village. You know, that's kind of, I like what you're saying about how there are all these references that are out of time and space in terms of that photograph that inspired the work. But that's really sort of the pop song equivalent of painting guys drifting through space, which is what, you know,
I was thinking about it in terms of, remember you've seen
what Magritte was doing.
Yeah, Edward Hopper's Nighthawks, very famous painting of people in the corner diner, you know.
At two in the morning.
Yeah, right? I always loved when I was a kid. I think the first version of that I ever saw was a fake version of that, where they put like Marilyn Monroe and James Dean, all these people. And somehow that became almost like, before there was such a thing as a meme, it became a meme where people were taking that setup and putting their own things inside of it. It was like a box that you could then put whatever you want. I think I've seen Star Wars versions of that, Lego versions of that. So, you know, Paul Simon was using this as just kind of a starting point to kind of put his own life into, you know, he's talking about himself,
right?
You know,
absolutely.
And using art as a starting point for that.
I wanted to go next to classical music, if I dare. This is something from Pictures at an Exhibition, which was originally a piano work, a sort of piano suite that the Russian composer Modest Mussorgsky.
Mussorgsky.
Yeah, that's right. Actually close enough for podcast purposes,
all right,
I think. And 19th century, you know, all the Russian drama you would expect. But this piece was sort of different for him. Pictures at an Exhibition was something that was directly inspired by a memorial exhibition of painting sketches and drawings by his late friend, Victor Hartmann, who had died about a year previously at 39. And so Mussorgsky goes to this show and afterwards decides he's going to create a series of piano originals that capture sort of the variety and the vitality and the whole experience of what he's walked through. He's going to create pictures at an exhibition.
Well, it's such an interesting
concept,
the idea that you could use music to relay what the experience of going to a gallery is.
Totally,
like,
yeah.
Which seems to me impossible.
And just so, like, especially for, like, a Russian composer working in the 1870s to come up with that. I mean, the Impressionists or somebody like that, a little bit later, I could more understand that. But, like, interestingly, the work, you know, really caught on, needless to say, and is probably more known now for the orchestral version of this piano work that the great Impressionist Maurice Ravel created. And by the way, we could have a whole other conversation about just the idea of Impressionism in painting and then in music. The musical idea, much like what we're talking about throughout this show, came after the visual idea and was sort of like in tribute.
So like Bolero
totally.
And things like that. So you know what's, I've always thought if you had to explain colors to a blind person.
Right.
I've always thought if you met someone who had never seen anything and you said, here is what red is or here is what blue is, I feel like I personally do not have the capability of explaining something like that to them. And I always think, how would you do something like this? It seems like an equally strong task to say, I'm going to explain something that happens in person via an art form like music. It just seems like a big, daunting task. But he pulled it off.
Yeah, well, in a way, it really is daunting. But in another sense, it's sort of like, what an opportunity. What a great inspiration that could be to, like, say, this is what red would sound like. This is what blue would sound like. And, you know, it sort of comes down to how you yourself experience it and feel it. And so we'll have a little bit of the piano original of the part of Pictures at an Exhibition called The Gnome. By the way, it is, like I said, a series of sonic pictures. So there's one called The Old Castle, there's one called The Gnome, and so on and so on. We're going to hear The Gnome for solo piano, and then we're going to segue into the majestic prog rock band Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
You're going prog.
I must, when given the opportunity. From the live album recorded in 1971 called Pictures at an Exhibition, we'll hear a little bit more of The Gnome through their lens.
Thank you.
Oh, right. Emerson Lake and Palmer. The gnome from Pictures at an Exhibition.
It's been a while.
It's been too long, man. The program you're listening to is the Museum Confidential podcast, and we pause now for a word from our sponsors. This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Frames. Wood, metal, plastic, glass, the choices are nearly endless. According to an unscientific 2016 poll conducted by the National Frame Guild, 71% of museum visitors prefer art in frames. The other 29% are clearly anarchists. We at Museum Confidential love frames. In fact, the walls of our offices and homes are lined with them. Give your unframed prints and paintings the life partners they so richly deserve. Give them that Jerry Maguire moment.
You?
It's hard to follow Prague. I'm not going to pretend like it's not. I don't even honestly know where to go after that. But we've been talking about a lot of songs inspired by artists and painters, but there's also bands who kind of take their name or identity from the world of art. I saw a documentary a few years ago called In the Realms of the Unreal about a underground artist named Henry Darger, a guy who lived in Chicago who basically went unknown his whole life. He lived in an apartment, tiny apartment, worked as basically a janitor. And when he died, when they went into his apartment, they found this amazing treasure trove of artwork and what is considered to be the longest novel ever written, like 15,000 pages.
Okay.
What's interesting is all these things are connected by one basic narrative that he was working on. So all of his artwork, which is very kind of illustration-based, he would paint on these canvases and just have them rolled up in the corner like oriental rugs. And they found all these things, and they were about a mythical storyline about what he called the Vivian girls, which were these asexual characters. You didn't know if they were boys or girls. There was all kinds of strange things happening. I've seen some of his work in person over the years, and it really is unlike anything else. But there's this...
Do you know that book by John Ashbery called Girls on the Run?
No.
The late New York progressive poet John Ashbery...
Just recently died.
Yeah, absolutely. And he had a book called Girls on the Run that was inspired by this artist and his work. And
Henry Darger.
Yeah, and it was inspired by his creations, and it's a book of poems by Ashbery.
Yeah, the work is fascinating. It's sexual, but it's also... naive. It's a very strange work. So there was this, probably about 8 years ago, I saw this debut album come out by a girl group called the Vivian Girls.
Okay.
Kind of a surf rock, echoey. I love this kind of stuff. There's a band called Best Coast that I've been a fan of for a while. They have this kind of like Riot Girl music, if anybody kind of knows what that was, kind of early 90s music, but mixed with this.
Here you are in the early
California.
90s again.
I know. That's where I keep going back to. The kind of this California vibe that goes along with it. But they called themselves the Vivian Girls, inspired by this mythical, weird world that Henry Darger created. And this is a song called Where Do You Run To, which is nothing to do about Henry Darger or the work. The band just kind of took their identity or name from that. But it's, about 10 years old now or so, and it's just something people need to know more about.
Let's do it. All right, the Vivian Girls. I'm Scott Gregory, and you are Jeff Martin. And that's one of your selections dating back to your younger days, the early 90s. It's funny how, so much of what we carry in terms of musical associations and favorite bands and all of that really does stem from those late adolescent years.
Well, so much of it, stuff that I know is not even great.
Yeah, but,
I'm tied into it.
And it's about where you were when you came to it and how it just really registered with you in that particular moment, I think.
Yeah, if I'm driving down the street and I turn on the radio or I'm listening to something and Four Non-Blondes comes on.
Yes.
I won't turn it off.
Yeah.
But I also know I don't really like it that much, and I don't know where that intersects at some strange point.
Yeah, that's... And within that, there's also like the stuff that's undeniably great. Like when I was in high school, the Smiths were my favorite band, and they're sort of like, you know, the creme de la creme of a certain kind of new wave music. All of their albums I committed to memory decades ago, but sometimes I can step back and say, okay, this is a little silly, but at the same time, damn, it's good. It just pushes the right buttons.
So much of it too, I think, is about you had time to obsess about things.
Yes. And it was all about you and your concerns and your teenage years and all of that. That's true. That's a good point. And I think for a lot of people, just more generally, like, that's the station that they stay with on the radio throughout the rest of life. I mean, I know we don't all just listen to radio anymore. I mean, I can admit that even though I work in radio. But like, they just stay there. You know, they just stay there. Like, Zeppelin is it, and that will always be it.
And we have to push ourselves, I think.
Yeah,
you have to make a conscious decision to stay engaged with the world at large. You know?
Which is so much about what museums are for and what's great about going to them and experiencing new things.
Yes, I like Impressionist art. Mm-hmm. I like classical art. I like Baroque stuff. But maybe I'll like this interesting modern thing,
or even
maybe you won't,
or even like I admire this particular space and I've gotten so much out of this particular museum that I'm going to go there even if I don't know this particular artist, if I don't know this work, I'm going to go check it out.
I think the being open to the new is
On that note of things that you know, you came to in your late adolescence, maybe your early 20s, Lou Reed and John Cale of the Velvet Underground, of course, about whom we'll hear more later in the show.
A teaser.
They put out an album right after their friend and mentor Andy Warhol died. It was called Songs for Drella, subtitle A Fiction. There's a lot of biography in this work of fiction. In fact, the album, which I recommend highly, pretty much tells the entire story of Warhol's life, from growing up in a small town, which is the first song on the album, to the rise to fame, the factory, the various periods of his career, and then like when that woman tried to shoot and kill him, and then when
Valerie Solanas.
All of that is in this amazing sort of...
Who's Drella?
Drella is short for Cinderella, which was a nickname they had for him, of course. And so we're going to hear a tune called Images, which is about Warhol's process, or at least one of his techniques as an artist. You'll recognize lines like, I think images are worth repeating, images repeated in a painting. Lou Reed, John Cale, the album released in 1990.
I think images are worth repeating, images repeated from a painting. Images taken from a painting, from a photo worth re-seeing. I love images worth repeating, project them upon the ceiling, multiply them with cell screening, see them with a different feeling. Images, those images, images, those images. Some say images have no feeling. I think there's a deeper meaning.
All right, Lou Reed and John Cale from the album Songs for Drella. We had part of Images there. And what do you have in store next, Jeff?
So when I think Warhol, I really am, and the Velvet Underground especially, I'm thrown back into the late 60s and that kind of, you know, they weren't hippies, but they were certainly part of this kind of art movement that was happening. They were more than New York rather than California, but out in California you had all this stuff happening. You know, we're 50 years now from the Summer of Love, right, and Monterey Pop and all those different things. It was kind of funny back then, bands that kind of came of age during the early British invasion, so like Dave Clark Five, of course, Beatles, all these other bands, a few years into that, so let's say that's happening 63 64, right? Kinks, of course. A few years into that, there's bands having identity crisis. You know, they don't know what to be doing. They're saying, well, do we need to adapt and change our sound? Do we need to start sounding more like these quote-unquote, you know, hippie bands.
Oh, you mean like the country rock thing?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. You had that going on with, you know, Graham Parsons and all those, the Birds and those things. But you have a band like, what's the first thing you think of when I say Herman's Hermits to you? You say, Henry VIII I am. What are you going for?
I was trying to remember that guy's name. Was it Peter Noon?
Peter Noon.
Yes. Okay.
Known mostly now for maybe doing Time Life commercials.
Those priceless infomercials.
Yes.
Yes. That's where I went.
But, you know, they had a few big hits, of course. You know, I'm Into Something Good.
Which is a lovely pop song.
Mrs. Brown.
Yes.
You've got a lovely daughter. And they had that sound. You know, some bands from England never sound like they're from England.
Yeah.
Hermits definitely sounded like they were from England.
You know? With a healthy dollop of sort of sunshine pop in there. Yeah.
There's a kind of hush.
Yes.
All over the world. That's a great tune.
Okay.
But so by the late 60s, they're doing something where they sound more like Donovan. And I found this great little track called Museum, which I don't think is called Museum for any other reason that the word museum appears in it once. And you can hear it. You'll hear this kind of late 60s influence on this otherwise buttoned up Brit band.
Okay. Right, Herman's Hermits and Museum. I have to follow Museum now with something totally different. Also a one-word title. This is a piece called Picasso, believe it or not, from 1948. Coleman Hawkins is considered the father of the jazz saxophone. The saxophone had existed, of course, in music before Coleman Hawkins came along in the early 20s, but it wasn't really a jazz instrument. He made it one. And he was in the music from those classic jazz days of like the 20s into the swing and the big band era of the 40s and early 50s. But he was also an amazing bebop player, influencing people like Thelonious Monk and Sonny Rollins well into the 50s and then the 60s. Coleman Hawkins had an amazing career in jazz. And this is something that he did in 1948, as I say. First of all, it's a solo saxophone recording, which was very rare for the time. In fact, this might be the first ever sort of unaccompanied saxophone recording. And when you're Coleman Hawkins and you're, you know, a person with that much clout, you can go into a studio, which is very expensive, and cut a side like this. And it's basically him flexing all his muscles as a musician. And he put the name Picasso on it. Maybe we can hear why.
Picasso by the great Coleman Hawkins. We could have done a whole show on songs about referencing or with the name Picasso in them.
Because
when I was looking up stuff about, you know, songs about art, That's the one that's the go-to. I'm just going to kind of run down a list of artists who have name-checked Picasso in titles of their songs. Okay. So you've got Paul McCartney in Wings. You've got Jay-Z.
Right.
You've got Neil Diamond. You've got the Grateful Dead. Jonathan Richman, who we talked about earlier. John Cale, who we talked about earlier. That's the go-to. You know, so I'm glad we picked this one.
Which is not to say that it's necessarily cliche, but it's sort of like it's a Miles Davis thing where so many different people see so much within that one performer in his work. And he had a long and varied career, you know, the different periods of art and all of that.
I mean, he died, what, in the 70s?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and you hear about Picasso having these periods, right? The late period, the blue period, all these different things. And jazz musicians have a lot of these things too. You know, they'll have these phases, and musicians in general, they'll have these phases where they have peaks and valleys. Where they say, well, you know, or writers, you know, Philip Roth's a good example of someone who's had these peaks and valleys and different moments where they
were just trying new
more
things.
Relevant, experimental. Yeah. Someone who's done that a ton over the years is Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And so Dylan writes this song, When I Paint My Masterpiece. And it was a song that he never officially put out on one of his albums. But the band, you know, the band, his backup band, that then became the band with Robbie Robertson, Lee Von Helm, and all
those
great
known
guys,
as the Hawks.
The Hawks. They record it, you know, and they recorded a lot of Dylan tunes at the time. You know, and Dylan dabbled in art, too. He painted covers. He did the cover of the band's Music at Big Pink.
Right. I think it might be Music from Big Pink. Okay. Did he do that? He also did the cover of the album, I think, Self-Portrait.
Yeah, that's right.
And he painted the,
So he did a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And he's shown work over the years. But I think when it comes down to hearing the version of When I Paint My Masterpiece, you got to go with the band. You got to go with Lee Von Helm. Let's hear it.
Oh, the streets of Rome are filled with rubble. Ancient footprints are everywhere. You can almost think that you're seeing double.
When I Paint My Masterpiece, of course, the Bob Dylan masterpiece performed there by the band. And, you know, there's a lot of Dylan songs that reference art and artists. I was thinking of playing something from Visions of Johanna, which goes back to Blonde on Blonde from 1966. There's a line in there, inside the museums, infinity goes up on trial. Voices echo, this is what salvation must be like after a while, which is just
classic,
like,
Dylan.
Just amazing as a poem. And I was doing some research before the show. The British poet Andrew Motion, when he was poet laureate in the late 90s, called that the greatest song lyric ever written. That is Visions of Johanna. I could play that, but we just heard some Dylan, so I'm going to go in a different direction.
People can go hear that on their own.
People could go hear that on their own. We were talking about how he's also a painter. I mean, so many of the great pop musicians.
He's doing a lot of iron work lately.
That's what I've heard. But the list is long of people who, like, went to art school and then became a pop performer, musically speaking. John Lennon, I think the Talking Heads. Didn't all of the Talking Heads go to RISD?
Yes, and Talking Heads, who close out every episode of the Museum Confidential podcast,
they certainly
by
do.
The way.
This woman we're going to hear from now is also a painter. This is Joni Mitchell from her album called Clouds, her second album, late 1960s release. This is the album Clouds that has Both Sides Now and I think Chelsea Morning. We're going to hear a song called The Gallery.
When I first saw your gallery, I liked the ones of ladies. Then you began to hang up me. You studied to portray me in ice and greens and old blue jeans and naked in the roses. Then you got into funny scenes that all your work discloses. Lady, don't love me now.
Joni Mitchell. I love the only a painter or maybe an art critic could come up with a line like, or rather come up with a series of lines like, then you begin to hang up me, you studied to portray me in ice and greens and old blue jeans and naked in the roses. Then you got into the funny scenes that all your work discloses, that verb discloses there. We have one more, I guess, we want to go out with, keeping things sort of folky, right, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, and it's the one that we've waffled on a little bit. It's the one that maybe is the only song about a painter that was a number one hit in the UK. And I think got up to number 12 on the US charts on an album called American Pie. And it's called Vincent by Don McLean. And you know this song. You've heard this probably, what, a million times you've heard this song?
Right. Yeah, of course.
And it tells the story of Vincent van Gogh, you know, this suicidal painter in late 19th century. And then there's this whole thing about whether he actually killed himself or not. We don't have even close to enough time to get into that. A couple of years ago, there was this big study that came out saying he may have been murdered by children.
Wow.
And didn't actually kill himself. And so we don't have time to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I think it'd be better off if we just dim the lights, thought about something sad, and listened to Vincent by Don McLean.
Early 70s?
Yeah, and, you know, everybody knows Starry, Starry Night.
Let's hear it.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land.
Walter Chrysler Jr., heir to the namesake automobile company, had established himself as a preeminent art collector by the early 1940s. Following the sale of the Chrysler building in 1956, he retired from an active role in the car business to devote his time completely to the arts. In 1958, he founded the Chrysler Art Museum in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Over the next decade, the collection began to outgrow its limited space in a converted 19th century church. After visiting dozens of potential locations, he accepted an offer in 1971 from the city of Norfolk, Virginia, where the museum now resides. A few years before the big move, on August 31st through September 4th, 1966, Andy Warhol brought his happening to the Chrysler, the exploding plastic inevitable. The happening featured a series of concerts by Andy's pet project, an up-and-coming band he was managing called the Velvet Underground. He dropped the band the next year.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa.
To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.